Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 5:27, and that is in St. Louis, Missouri. And I'm here because my daughter is competing tomorrow in the National Fencing Championships for the first time. So I apologize for the late recording of the audio and video. This has been a rather momentous week because the USA imposed tariffs of approximately $34 billion on China at midnight last night. So now the question is, what's next? Well, the renminbi had declined pretty seriously all the way through the second half of June in advance of this move, and there is a certain quality of sell the rumor, buy the news to this market. The dollar has been rallying in a very persistent manner, and it is a little bit overbought in the short term, so there is certainly scope here for some pause and consolidation. And we saw some evidence of that starting to happen in the middle of this week. So there is now the prospect that the dollar is going to weaken somewhat from the very overbought condition that it had. But when we look at the medium-term chart, I think we get a very clear picture that the dollar's more than year-long progression of lower rally highs against the renminbi has been broken. There is certainly this overbought condition, but it's a massive reaction against that prevailing downtrend. And generally speaking, after you get that, you get a period of ranging. Well, it looks like that period of ranging is just now beginning. So we can anticipate that the dollar will experience some consolidation, not just against the renminbi, but against most of the emerging market currencies. And a substantial number of emerging market stock market indices are really quite oversold in the short term. The Indonesian rupiah had been quite weak, and the Jakarta composite has broken down below the trend mean for the first time since it popped back above it at the beginning of 2016. But we're seeing just nascent signs that support is starting to come back in. But of course, it really does have some work to do now. It has to push back above the trend mean to confirm more than short-term steadying in this market. The Indian rupee moved to a new low this week. And not just any new low, but a new closing low historically. Well, this is the big question, that it isn't simply that the RBI needs to step in and do more, but it's also on the fiscal front that Narendra Modi has got an election coming up, and there is no denying the fact that he has, just by becoming Prime Minister, he has upset the political establishment in India by being the first lower caste person to become Prime Minister. And he is certainly more business oriented than the previous administration, but he is a populist. And it is quite likely that he's going to try and buy the election. Well, if we don't get higher interest rates and we get a more fiscal profligacy in India, well, then that is going to have an impact on the rupee. So this is a rather key level, not least because it didn't strengthen by any discernible amount really in here today. But nonetheless, it is at an area of potential support here in the region of the historic lows. So this is an important area where if it's going to steady, then this would be a very convenient place for it to do so, and not least because lots of people are very aware of this level. The South African rand had weakened all the way to 14 to the dollar, but it started to steady in here today. So I think the biggest, the clearest message here is that the dollar is overbought in the short term, but that it has rallied enough that it is now it has raised very large questions for the consistency of its medium-term downtrend, not just against the renminbi, but just against just about every currency, and that the likelihood is that we're going to get some mean reversion. But then it's the big question is what happens next. Well, we know what else is everyone is worried about. It's about trade wars. Well, China does not import as much from the USA as the USA does from China, so it's going to be difficult to impose tariffs. But what they can certainly do is institute a program of making life difficult for companies that want to do business in China and access China's large consumer economy. Considering, of course, that China's consumer economy didn't really exist a decade ago and it has flourished over the course of the last 5 years in particular. And the digital economy is also leading the charge, that China's digital economy is on par, or if not exceeding, that of just about everywhere else. And that's also one of the reasons to be somewhat more positive about India, because they just got 4G a year ago. Well, I guess it's a year and a half ago now. Reliance Industries is the well owns the 4G network, and it continues to trend higher. Obviously, it has lost momentum so far this year, but that was a rollicking advance that we had back in 2017, so it was due some consolidation, but it would really need to be taking or sustaining a move below the trend mean to question potential here for additional upside. Well, if we think about trade wars, there are the logical and unfortunate, I think, conclusion, or perhaps a conclusion is not the right word. They're the logical progression of events that we can see from the rise of populism. Populism is not suddenly becoming a popular movement right across the world for no reason. It's rather that this has been something that's been going on for years. I had a conversation with a Chinese person who has a logistics company in Los Angeles about a year ago, and he was trying to sell his business to Mrs. Tracy, and she demurred, but we had a good long conversation about his wrought iron business that he's importing. He was doing a drop shipping business from manufacturers in China for some of the largest lighting companies in the USA, and also he had this wrought iron lamp business. But it turns out that he got into the logistics business because his first job was going over to places like Sweden and Finland and buying lumber mills, and then packing up the entire plant and paper production plants and shipping them back to China and just simply reestablishing them over there. That was, I think, for me, that was almost a light bulb moment in terms of the denuding of manufacturing capacity from places in Europe and North America and literally lifting them and dropping them into the industrial bases that we see in China. Well, that left deep rifts in the economic fabric of lots of different countries. And the reality is that that economists and the mainstream view has been that all of that was good, that it was going to help emerging markets and China in particular to advance in terms of their GDP per capita, and that would eventually translate into them becoming more liberal and adopting democracy, because that's what we've seen in lots of other countries, and that it would encourage upskilling in Europe and North America, so that people would simply migrate to better jobs. But that isn't at all what's happened. That what we in fact see is that when people start to tout the evolution of the services economy, that they don't seem to really make a clear point of exactly what type of services they're talking about. Because when we think about who are the highest paid people in the economy, generally speaking, it is those that are in the professional sectors, that are in the protected sectors by regulation and education, such as law, accountancy, and medicine. Then you have the people who are engineers and highly educated, but they often work in manufacturing operations, and they help to skew the wage for manufacturing sectors. But if we look at, for example, UK data, and I've compiled the averages from the National Securities Agency, Statistics Agency in the UK, it's quite clear that manufacturing is higher paid than basic services. In fact, people that are working in the food and beverage manufacturing sector generally tend to make about as much as a teacher. And teachers are about middle of the road in terms of the wage, I think, tables. But the real growth in services has been in the service sector. And that's not at all what people tend to think about in terms of services. When people think about the growth of the services industry and that this is a wonderful factor for the economy, they're thinking about Google and Facebook. They're not thinking about people that are working as cleaners or working as personal trainers or people that are working in nail salons, or hairdressers, or people that are working in hotels. But that is where the bulk of the growth has happened. And what that has meant is that people who were previously working in very well-paid jobs have now seen that their wages have contracted and contracted really quite meaningfully. And obviously, people are not happy about that. One of the reasons that coal miners tend to get out and protest vociferously about the closing of their mines is because coal mining is generally a very well-paid job, and it's usually a mono-industry area. That in fact, it is such a well-paid job that there is no incentive to do anything else. So, therefore, you get this environment where you have had millions of people disenfranchised as a result of their manufacturing jobs being lifted and planted into the emerging markets. And I think it is really the institutional response to the credit crisis has been the catalyst to really get people properly angry because they were asked to make even more sacrifices, both in terms of the services that they are receiving and the taxes that they pay, in order to bail out people that did not suffer the same consequences as they did from taking very large risks. So that's, I think, a very important characteristic. That is why populism is rising. That is also why we have the trade war rhetoric and indeed action that has been instituted in here today. This is a process. And what we also see is that we've had a break. Now, something that we talk about in the chart seminar is that a range is an explosion waiting to happen. Well, we can consider that when you look at the political environment that has prevailed in Europe and the USA and lots of other places over the course of the last 20 years, it has been a narrowing of the field, that centrism has prevailed, that the difference between left and right has been primarily leverage, well, not so much leverage, let's say the difference has been more personality and history oriented than actual policy oriented. That has resulted in disaffected voters not having a choice. So when you do get a break, well, it is then that people go for the extreme, because ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And when you get a breakout, it is surprising, and people are left wondering whether this is a new bull market or a new bear market, or whether everything is going to reverse quickly. The people that want to support it generally think, well, golly, it's gone too far already. It couldn't possibly go up anymore. But that is just not the case. And that is why I've left up the chart of Reliance Industries. If you look at it, for example, it went sideways between about 2012 and 2016, and nobody thought that anything was going to happen. And then it doubled. And that's something that we see in charts all the time, but we're not used to seeing it in other areas of our life, and yet that is exactly what has happened in the political sphere. Therefore, I think that the likelihood is that we are in a reordering of the global economy, that people are ticked off, and that they are going to continue to vote for extreme viewpoints until they get what they want. And what they want is a return to the standard of living that they had before. And the only way that that is going to occur is if we get back to the administrations of different countries acting for the benefit of their own people. What is particularly interesting is that there was an article on Bloomberg during the week listing how many of Europe's former politicians are now in the employ of the Chinese state. And Romano Prodi in Italy and David Cameron in the UK are at the top of the list. And this is really quite profound, that China is a country with global ambitions. And from an investor's perspective, there is no point getting into a political diatribe, but from an investor's perspective, when we think about governance, the reason that we say governance is everything is because it's nice when you invest in a country that you might be able to get your money back later. So if you're going to get your money back later when you want to sell, that you will in fact be able to sell, well, you need respect for minority shareholder interests because you do not want to get your position absorbed by the state or by some corrupt process. So you need to have investor rights, you need to have respect for property rights, and you need to have respect for minority shareholder interests. Well, then you also need to have an independent judiciary because there is absolutely no country that is bereft of some form of corruption. But it is nice that if you have an independent judiciary that you can at least have recourse to the courts and you might be able to have your case heard. Then you need to have a free press because you need to be able to get the word out and you need to be able to make a big fuss. And that there is no better way to do that than to have a free press. Well, China has none of those things. So what people have then therefore been betting on is that that this is capitalism with Chinese characteristics has been the go-to phrase over the last couple of decades. But that's not at all the case. What in fact we're being presented with is national socialism, that private enterprise is being tolerated only insofar as it can fulfill the aims of the state. And that is a really rather questionable way of dealing with markets. That Milton Friedman preached that the only purpose of a corporation was to generate profits for shareholders. But in China, that is simply not the case. So again, that represents another risk premium for the market. Then you also have the fact that the administration there is no longer has a process for picking a new leader because they have a leader for life, and they are engaged in a robust campaign against the freedom of association and the social scorecard scheme that has been introduced and is being trialed in three different ways across three different cities is going to become central policy within the next year, if not the 2 years. Well, then that is going to further take us away from the flowering of democracy and liberal ideas that was hoped for when all of this largesse was poured onto China with its entry into the WTO. China has used its pocketbook to gain access to the political class of lots of different countries, not only in Europe but also in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. That it now has military bases and are ports under its control in Djibouti, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka, and that it has been able to secure these by making loans at not particularly favorable levels. And when the country is unable to pay them, then these terms are called in. So we know what China is intent on doing. Now, its stock market is pulling back in a very violent manner. And the fact that the renminbi has begun to pause suggests that we may be in for some pause in consolidation too, not least because the index is back in the region of the lows that we saw back in 2016. But this has been a substantial deterioration, and I guess there is certainly potential for a bounce that could take us back up towards the trend mean, but it has got a lot of work to do to really help to reinvigorate the bulls and to I think quiet some of the issues that people have. Well, the big question I think that lots of people are asking is this going to contribute to a market top? And that's a very important question because it's not, I don't think it's probably going to contribute to a market top on its own. But we do know that we have to at least answer that question within the framework of where we are in terms of this cycle. And the medium-term cycle is maturing because we already know that the size of central bank balance sheets is contracting. And that is very clear on this graphic that I've been posting practically on a daily basis. It's been coming down since last year. We have already seen that more than $1 trillion has been taken out of circulation, and there is no real sign yet that that process is over. This is the largest pullback in terms of central bank balance sheets we've seen since the beginning of 2009. So, when we start the very first day at the chart seminar, we talk about the fact that there are really only two things that we look at in markets. One is crowd psychology and how that is being represented in terms of the price action. And the second one is money flow. It is much easier to make money when there's lots of money about, and it is going to be more difficult to make money when there's less of it. So central bank balance sheets are contracting, and that is contributing to tighter financial conditions, not just in one country, but everywhere. And we've got ample evidence of that in terms of the yield curve spread. So the yield curve spread is at 28.5 basis points, and it has been coming down rather sharply over the course of the last few months, but also it's been trending lower since the beginning of 2014. If we simply look at that on a daily basis, we can see just how consistent the trend lower has been since the middle of May. Well, that is indicative of a tightening environment, but it is not yet so tight that it represents a headwind to profitability in the banking sector. But banking sector profits are being squeezed because the entire banking business model is to borrow short and lend long, and the spread that they're making has contracted from about 1% a year ago to 28 basis points today. So that is a significant tightening of margins. Now, when we look at the global bank sector, then what we're presented with is a very lengthy range, and this range looks very similar to any number of European stock market indices. But perhaps the more important point is that it had got up to post a new high, the highest level we'd seen since the beginning of 2011, and then failed. And it is continuing to trend lower at the current point. So this tells us that since this is an index of systemically important banks to the global economy, that we know that credit conditions are tightening. But they're tightening most particularly in China. And that is why the stock market has been pulling back so violently. The The banks index in China has pulled back from approximately 17,000 to 12,500 since the beginning of this year. And it is oversold in the short term. And certainly, I think anyone looking at that can say that 12,000 has represented an area of at least short-term support, particularly back in 2017, and that there is scope here for a bounce. But the bigger question is, what then? It really does need to not only bounce, it needs to find support above the low on a pullback, it needs to push back above the trend mean, and it needs to continue to hold progressions of higher reaction lows if the benefit of the doubt is to be given to the upside. So we are still in a very early stages here. And there is the possibility that the Chinese administration has probably overreached. Now, there is also an important point that is sort of out there on the horizon, and it is that both the USA and China have got brand new central bankers, people that are that haven't really been tested by a crisis. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that the market will provide a crisis to find out exactly what their mettle is and what way they're going to turn in the event of a crisis. So that doesn't necessarily mean the crisis is unfolding today, but it does suggest that at some stage we are going to have a recession, and that the recession is, I think, if we were going to think about where any of the risks are right now, the biggest risks are in China. That is where we have had the biggest deterioration. Whereas on Wall Street, the major stock market indices continue to hold the progression of higher reaction lows and continue to find support in the region of the trend mean. The S&P 500 had come right back down to 2,700, and then it was up one day, down the next, and it's now strung 2 days together on the upside and is bouncing from the 2,700 level and has held its progression of higher reaction lows. Well, there's not much more we can ask for in terms of the best possible scenario, considering that the market has been convalescing since the big pullback that we saw back in January and February. The Dow Jones, having actually broken its progression of higher reaction lows, has steadied at least from the region of the trend mean. And the NASDAQ 100 has also been really quite firm. Well, what this also helps to, I think, nail home is that the USA is doing well, not least because when we think about those two simple facts, that we still have reasonably consistent trends, that we've had a bigger pullback, and that was following an accelerated trend at the end of last year, but that Wall Street has got the benefit of fiscal stimulus. Whereas China is tightening, Japan is not aggressively increasing the size of its balance sheet any longer, and the European Union, or the EU, I should, excuse me, the ECB is on the cusp of stopping its quantitative easing program. So it is in the USA that you have the greatest evidence of monetary or fiscal accommodation, that we've had a transfer from monetary to fiscal accommodation, and that is translating into a stronger and more robust performance of Wall Street than we see in lots of other markets. But when we look at the bank sector, we can reach a similar conclusion, because it's the US banks have outperformed their global counterparts by a substantial margin, and they are generally better capitalized because the USA forced them to write down their bad loans. And the S&P 500 banks index is right in the region of the lower side of its range, so this is a natural area where it should begin to find support if in fact we are still in a bullish environment. Europe has got substantial issues because the economy is largely being run from the perspective of Germany, and that is why quantitative easing is being abandoned. But the European economy, particularly on the periphery, is not yet ready for that. And we do hold out the prospect that the kind of deflationary environment that the European markets encountered when they removed this about €1 trillion from circulation could prevail once more if they do, in fact, go ahead and decide that they need to reduce the size or abandon their purchase program is probably the better way of thinking about it. And because you have this very clear difference in performance between Wall Street and everywhere else, then that has contributed to very, I think, greater concentration of investing within the USA. I think that that trend has probably gone far enough in the short term, and that the emerging markets are due a bounce. And I think that that is perhaps the most likely scenario that we can anticipate over the course of the next couple of months. But there is the other point that the USA has adopted this fiscal profligacy, and they are going to run into a substantial hole in the budget when it's run its course. And that means there's going to be a lot more debt. Well, US treasuries right now are steadying. So the yield is pulling back. And it has not pushed through the 3% level. It's currently at about 2.82%. And this is about where, if it's going to find, if the yield is going to find support, then we could anticipate that happening. People are worried about trade wars, and they are worried about the health of the economic expansion that we had on the global economy last year. Last year, we could talk about synchronized global economic expansion. That is just not the case any longer. Economic expansion is much more spotty. So that is part of the reason that we've had a firmness in the 10-year Treasury price and some contraction in the yield. But the bigger question is what's going to be done with all the debt that needs to be refinanced and all the new debt that needs to be purchased. So that's where the market could experience indigestion. And the strength of the US dollar has acted as a tailwind for the Treasury markets because there was a big argument last year about whether one could really make any money from picking up the yield on Treasuries when bond yields were negative because the dollar was going down so fast. But this year the dollar has been going up and it has made the carry trade in bonds really quite attractive. So the fate of what's happening with the treasury markets is likely really quite tied to what's going on with the dollar. If the dollar does weaken, then that's going to result in some selling of treasuries and higher yields. So there is the there is a potential here that yields are going to begin to find support. When I look at the euro, then I think here we have, again, more evidence that the dollar has rallied through the trend mean. There is potential for it to unwind its oversold condition, but the euro has got an awful lot of work to do if it is going to resume its advance versus the dollar. If we're going to get mean reversion by the dollar, then there is the potential that gold will also unwind its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. And gold is right in the region of the lows that we saw last year. So this is a natural area for it to find support. Well, I was expressing confidence that gold was going to be able to push on the upside earlier this year, and I was positioned accordingly. And so far, I'm not quite willing to concede yet that I was wrong, but gold absolutely needs to find support here. Now, the big question is whether the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise interest rates. The fact that they are reducing the size of their balance sheet and raising interest rates at the same time, that is something that has not been tried before. And the reality is that we no longer have a synchronized global economic expansion. And high yield debt or high yield spreads broke out this week. Now we have the 10-year spread on high yield starting to break higher, and it's been already trending higher for the European high yield for at least the last 7 months. When we look at it in terms of the fact that the yield curve spread is contracting, that banking sectors have not been doing particularly well, that high yield is spreads are trending higher. Well, that's all pointing towards tighter financial conditions, tighter credit conditions generally. And that is likely to act as a headwind to the economy. And therefore, the question is whether the Federal Reserve will be able to continue to raise interest rates. Well, if the Federal Reserve stops raising interest rates, then the dollar will stop rallying. And then we may get some pickup again in the emerging markets because international investors like to have both the capacity for yield currency appreciation and capital market appreciation. But then if we're thinking about the long term, the most likely scenario is that we're moving into a multipolar world, that the U.S. electorate is expressing very little interest in maintaining the position of being the global police force. And protectionism is also pointing towards less interest in securing supply routes for major commodities like oil. The USA is now a major exporter of oil. It has an interest in having prices higher. And not so high that they represent a headwind to growth, but certainly not so low that it impedes the ability of the country to continue to export. Well, Brent crude is currently in the region of $80, and it has pulled back somewhat in here this week. It is due some pause in consolidation. A reaction of anything up to a few months is not at all unlikely, considering what we know that oil is capable of doing. But if we are moving into a multipolar world, then that means that the global, if that is the most likely scenario, then the global supply chain is less likely to persist or is going to require some significant retooling. There are going to be various spheres of influence. And Europe is up for grabs because Europe has benefited from the security shield that the USA offered and the security of oil exports from the Gulf. That also has benefited Europe and benefited lots of other countries as well. If the USA becomes less engaged in the Middle East, then that is a very important consideration from a European perspective. Then we already know that China has got a substantial proportion of the centrist pro-globalization movement, a political movement, in its under its paywall. So that holds out the prospect that we are going to get a different set of outcomes for Europe, and that Europe could end up becoming more pro-Chinese than the USA does. When we think about a multipolar world, it does not necessarily mean that it is going to break along NATO lines. And this is, I think, one of the more delicate situations that we have. Now, if we really take a step back and think about all of this in terms of risk profiles, well, I spent the first 15 years in this service not having to talk about politics. And now it's absolutely vital. And the very fact that we have that change represents an additional risk premium. Now, if we know that that credit conditions are tightening, let's concentrate on the NASDAQ 100. Because this is an index that did spectacularly well. And since it broke north of 4,000 back in 2014, it spent a couple of years consolidating, and now it has pushed on and is now sustaining the move above 7,000. And I've previously described that as the best of all possible worlds, and that is exactly what it is doing so far. So as long as the NASDAQ is sustaining this move above 7,000, then there were two possible outcomes. When you get a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and then you get a failed upside break and a very sharp pullback, well, that could have been considered to be softening up, and that you could have ended up having a type 2 top with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, a range below the trend mean, and that could have contributed to a much lengthier medium-term correction. But there is the other outcome, and that is that this has been a somewhat more volatile medium-term correction, more similar to what we had in 2015 than anything else, and now there is the prospect that the market accelerates higher. Well, considering that the index has been rallying really since the end of 2008, then we are almost 10 years into this uptrend, and if this breakout is sustained, this uptrend is not over. Well, it holds out the prospect that this medium-term bull market will conclude with a mania, and that we already see, this is, I think, one of the most important points, that when we think about let me see if I can find multiple. I'm just typing this in. Excuse my. And I should really have had this ready previously. The Shiller PE ratio, or the cyclically adjusted PE, is at second highest level historically. But on the way up, all the way back here, in the mid 1990s. It was at a new all-time high. And everyone must have been looking at this and thinking, well, golly, valuations just don't matter anymore. That's exactly what they said, earnings don't matter. Well, now people who are of a fundamental bias are looking at the market and thinking, well, golly, this market has gone up a lot. And I think it's fully valued. And I know what happens, that eventually, that when these things go wrong, they go wrong in a big way. So I'm getting out. I had an email to that effect a couple of months ago, and I had another email to that effect this week. Well, the most important thing about this particular measure is that it is not a timing indicator. If you had sold in 1995, then the market went up an additional 100% after that. And now we're in a similar condition. People are looking at the market and thinking, well, it is fully valued based on how I measure it. But if we look at the trend is not over. And that is one of the most important points, that we are in a secular bull market. Within a secular bull market, you do get occasional recessions, and those recessions represent some of the most attractive buying opportunities. There will be a recession. It could potentially be sometime between 2019 and 2020, because that is when the fiscal, the so-called sugar high from fiscal stimulus in the USA runs out. It could be because of China being hit much harder as a result of trade frictions than is currently being priced in. After all, China has not had a recession in over, if it's not 20, it's certainly, or if it's not 30, it's definitely 20 years. So there is the potential that it is not that the USA need not be the focus of the crash on this occasion, just because it was the focus of the crash in 2000 and again in 2007, it does not mean that it is the only market in the world that is susceptible to a problem. And if we look at what's going on in China right now, I think that that is where we have the epicenter of risk. There is nothing on this chart that tells us that that CAPE ratio isn't going to make a new all-time high. That's not a prediction, but neither is it. Is there anything on the chart that says it's impossible? And that's a very important, I think, conclusion to reach, that it tells us that we are getting late in the cycle, but that it does not tell us that the cycle is over. It is only going to be when we get a significant peak, that when the Shiller PE ratio is already turning down, that we will have confirmation that a peak is in. But so far, there's no evidence of that. We are in a secular bull market. And I think the most useful graphic representation of that is the Dow gold ratio. And the Dow gold ratio is particularly useful because we've got so much back history. Well, we know that there's approximately 35 or 36 years between the peaks. And each one of the peaks is higher than the last. So therefore, it is not beyond the bounds of possibility that by the time this ratio eventually peaks, it would be approximately 35 years from the peak in 1999, and that it's the ratio level will be higher than 40. And that means that it could double between now and then. So that's assuming, of course, gold simply stays steady above $1,000. But that would mean that the Dow, if gold were at 1,000, it would mean the Dow Jones is at 40,000. If gold were lower than that, well, obviously, then the price level on the Dow would have to be wouldn't have to be quite as high. But of course, there is the possibility that my original conclusion was that gold is in a saucering pattern and that inflationary pressures do pick up, or that we do get gold pushing higher from here. Well, if we get gold pushing higher from here, then the end index level for the Dow could be substantially above the 40,000 level. But these are all prognostications. There is absolutely nothing to be gained from deciding which level a market is going to top out at if we're talking about 17 years from now. The much more important point is that we're in a secular bull market. It's being driven by technological innovation. Just today, Biogen announced rather positive trials on an Alzheimer's drug. And Alzheimer's is a killer, but it's not a quick killer. It's something that a huge percentage of the population suffers from, and it's a massive drain on productivity because of the number of family members that generally have to give up work to care for somebody. And there is the prospect that we do have that we get a cure for it at some point in the next 10 or 15 years. There's an increasing number of cancers that are curable, and that survival rates are approximately 50% in the UK after 10 years of from a diagnosis. They're 66% after 5 years in the USA after diagnosis. And that's a much better success rate than anything that we'd I think was even possibly imagined a decade ago. Innovation in energy and healthcare tend to drive bull markets because they all on their own enhance productivity growth. If we have healthier people that are living longer lives, then they can be productive for longer, and that encourages productivity growth in the economy. That's the kind of thing that can drive a secular bull market. The fact that this kind of technology is going global instantly means that there is going to be a rise in the number of people that fit into the global consumer class. And that's likely to grow exponentially over the course of the next couple of decades, not least because just about all the population growth is now happening in Africa. And that is where the newest consumers are going to be minted. Then we have the fact that energy prices have been contained. Generally speaking, oil prices tend to move in very long-term cycles. And when we look at the very long-term chart for oil, not just going back to 1970, but going back to the 1890s, we can see these long, very long ranges. Then we get these steps higher. Well, we've just had a step higher, and now we're in the long-term range, and the amplitude of that range is anywhere from approximately $35 to $120. So arguably, we're right in the middle of the range now. But we're not going to see prices going up much above that level because there is so much additional new supply is economic at current levels. And the higher prices go, the more of that supply comes online. And that will help to contain energy prices. Nonetheless, if energy prices surge higher from here, they will act as a headwind and they could be a contributing factor in the next recession. When we think about the fact that its defensive sectors tend to really turn to performance in at the end of a bull market, it's generally because bond yields are starting to come back down, and then the relative attractiveness of the reliable dividends that you get from the defensive sectors tend to be really burnished. Now, bond yields are contracting right now, so we've got defensive sectors that are starting to perk up. It really won't be until we get a recession that we get the next meaningful rally in bond yields. And that I really do think that we are in a different environment for bonds right now. That does represent a challenge for the yield sector in equities. It means that they are going to have to be more aggressive in raising their dividends, not just in buying back their shares. So we can certainly think about the performance of the buyback sector. When we look at the PKW Buyback Achievers ETF, it has a relatively similar price chart to the Dow Jones, particularly over the last 2.5 years. But it is now also finding support in the region of the trend mean. It is buybacks and dividends that the majority of earnings are going towards right now. That also means that corporate profits are going to be a key factor in the sustainability of this bull market. But generally speaking, when we think about what the earnings are likely to be from the second quarter, then estimates are that they're going to come in on a reasonably bullish front. So when we take a step back and we think about where are we in terms of the cycle, we are, I think, in the very short term, it is Wall Street that is leading, and now we have the potential for some of the oversold conditions on it, particularly in the emerging markets in Europe, to play catch up. But medium term, we know that we're in the latter stages of a bull market, that when you get credit conditions starting to tighten, then that does represent the latter stages of a bull market. But if we go back and think about 2006, the market went up about 30% after the yield curve went inverted, before it peaked. So we then, I think, when we get tighter credit conditions, it's when we have to become more diligent about monitoring the consistency of trends and less tolerant of inconsistency, rather than just selling up, because telling the market what to do is a waste of time because it doesn't listen. And longer term, well, if we're late in the medium-term cycle, well, we're really only halfway through the secular cycle. It means that the next time we do get a recession, it will represent a wonderful buying opportunity, and that the next really big peak, when we can anticipate a much larger pullback that does not then subsequently move on to and to sustained new highs, may not occur until the early to mid 2030s, at least in my view. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.